Good morning. My name is Mary Pearl. I'm an Al-Anon who likes to be happy, joyous, and free. The reason I always say that is because, are there any members of the other fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in the room? Well, I went to a meeting one night, a speaker meeting, and they asked me if I would share that night, and I heard a comment from a couple of them, and they said, "Oh God, we've got to listen to another suffering Al-Anon." And I thought, no, you're going to suffer. And so when I got up, I said, for the benefit of those three over there, if y'all would like to leave now, you may, before I start suffering. No, I like to know that recovery in my life means that I can be happy, joyous, and free. And you know, oh, I love this. This rocks. And it has, over my life, you know, I've had a lot of things happen, just like you have. Because in here we learn we have to live life on life's terms. And sometimes life can be really crappy with its terms, I'm here to tell you. But you know, sooner or later, I have to come back to being happy, joyous, and free, or I couldn't get through stuff. You know, and so God has blessed me with the ability sometimes to see something funny or even bizarre in the midst of a bunch of garbage. You know, and so I like to know that. But I want to tell you first that I am a member of the Rose City Big Book Black Belt Al-Anon Family Group. We believe in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which isn't always popular a lot of places, but it's more popular in the South. And we do study that in addition to our Al-Anon literature. We take the program very seriously, but we don't take ourselves very seriously at all. You know, we have learned to lighten up. Everything is not the end of the world and such a big deal. It's not all about me, mostly, but not all. You know, and I want to tell you to begin with that I'm not an authority on Al-Anon, the 12 steps, or anything. I'm going to share with you my experience. You know, if I tell you about my ideas and my thoughts and whatever, you can argue with those, but you cannot argue with my experience. You know, but that is the one thing that I have, and it's one of the things that we're told. Our experience is our greatest asset that we have to give to the newcomer, is to tell you what my life used to be like, what happened, and what my life is today as a result of bringing the program home and working it inside my home, my life, my body, my thoughts, and what have you, to become oriented into the program principles of the 12 steps. I'm not sharing theories here today, you know, and you, like I say, you may not have had all the experiences, I hope you haven't, that I have had. And, you know, when I got here, I felt like that everybody in the world would have done exactly what I did, given the same set of circumstances. And I found out there were other ways to respond to things instead of always being the reactor, you know, that kind of thing. I am qualified for Al-Anon. I was qualified the day I arrived on Earth. My mother's family, her mother, her father, two brothers, and sister were alcoholics. My mother was the only non-drinking member of her family. I think she needed one. She was by far the sicker of all of them, you know. The untreated Al-Anon is a sick puppy, I'll tell you. You know, and she had experienced things that are beyond anything I can imagine, having been brought up in all of that alcoholism and the abuse that went with it. And so when, like I say, there was never any alcohol in our home except at Christmas time, Mother would make one little thing of eggnog punch. And as a child, you weren't allowed to drink it, so it didn't make any difference to me. My first memory of my grandfather was he was all bandaged up where he had gotten rolled after he had gotten drunk, and he had gotten a big fight, and he was all battered, and they had to take him to the hospital, and they brought him back. And my first memory of him is sitting at our kitchen table looking like what I thought the mummy looked like. And I was terrified of him. And my mother had said, "Stay away from Papa when he's drinking because he's really mean." So I was terrified of my grandfather for good reason. My mother's father, he died of wet brain from alcoholism when I was in high school. My grandmother died of cirrhosis of the liver from her alcoholism. My mother's oldest brother was shot in bed with another man's wife. He was drunk at the time, but he was my favorite. He was sort of like me. He was addicted to excitement. That's the way it was. There was only one uncle on my father's side that had a drinking problem, and it was an uncle by marriage, my aunt's husband. And I never knew he had a drinking problem. I just knew that every morning, he never said much, really. Every morning, the bootlegger would come and leave a quart fruit jar of what looked like water, it was clear, on the porch and take the money out from under the little dish and go his merry way. And my uncle just sipped out of this quart fruit jar, which today we know was white lightning, and he was just sort of mellow all day long. He never caused any problems. He just maintained. And after my aunt died, he maintained until he had to go to the nursing home. He was dead in a week from DTs from alcoholism. He didn't get that white lightning at the nursing home. Tragedy. My spouse, by the grace of God, is a member in good standing of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in January we'll have 30 years of continuous sobriety. You know. And that applause is for him, his higher power, and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if it weren't for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, we wouldn't be here, people. We wouldn't be here. You know. Remember, we borrowed their program. You know, we borrowed their program. So as you can see, I am well qualified to be up here because I've always had alcoholics in my life. And I've always felt like I was a carrier because wherever I go, I can find them. You know, wherever I go, there they are. Well, I've learned in here that wherever I go, there I am, you know. Yes. Gray Chrysler Caravan, license number ACMS213. You're blocking the entrance to the chip wagon. You will be destroyed. And while I'm at it, I have another announcement. Would you please turn off your cell phones, beepers, pagers, or anything like that unless you are an organ donor or recipient? So if I hear one, we're going to clear the way for you to leave. Okay. Now, as I told you, that was my qualification for Al-Anon. That's not what makes me an Al-Anon. What makes me an Al-Anon is not the mere fact I qualify. What makes me an Al-Anon is I am someone who attends Al-Anon meetings on a regular basis. I work the 12 steps and 12 traditions in my life. I am actively helping others to recover through the program of Al-Anon. That's what makes me an Al-Anon. You know, when I came in, I would hear sometimes members of AA talk about their spouse and say, "My little Al-Anon." They never even went to meetings. I said, and I told a guy one night, I said, "That's like me going up to a practicing drunk and saying, 'Here's a member of AA.'" I said, when we're out there practicing our sickness instead of in our meetings trying to change our way of living, we are no more an Al-Anon than you are a member of AA. And he said, "I stand corrected." I said, "You're lucky you still stand." As I said, I'm a black belt mean Al-Anon. I'm a low bottom Al-Anon, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, in general, in order to work the 12 steps, I think there's some things that you have to have. And the first thing I think you need is a sponsor. I found that was what I needed. I needed someone that had been there, done that, knew the way. You know, I love to travel. It's a good thing. And when I travel and if I go on a tour, I put my money up and I want to get the most for my dollar wherever I'm going. So I have, and I listen to what the tour director says. And they'll tell you what to do and what not to do. And if you want to have a good experience for your money, then you'll do what they say do because they've been there, done that, they know. Or you can go off on your own and get out there in the weeds and wonder how that happened. And I find that in Al-Anon, you know, people say, well, how soon should I get a sponsor? And I go, I don't know. How soon do you want to get better? You know, you can put it off as long as you want to, but you're not going to get any better until you do something different. And the most important thing about sponsorship to me is accountability. I have someone that I am accountable to for my behavior and what I'm doing. It's someone, you know, when you're doing all your own thinking in your head, you will co-sign anything you think of. It's always a good idea because you had it. You know, it's like a baby, you know, you had your baby. This is your baby. You nurture it, you know. Well, my best thinking got me in a lot of trouble. And I told my sponsor when I got here, I said, I am a self-made woman. She said, yes, and look what self-made. You know, that sort of hurt my feelings. And your sponsor, if she's doing a good job or he, will hurt your feelings. Because they're not going to co-sign all your cockamamie, you know. And if you're doing so well, why are you here? You know, that's always my thing. When people come in, the doors of Al-Anon, they don't come in going, God, it was such a gorgeous day out. I thought I'd join Al-Anon. We usually come here because we're miserable, we're hurt, we're scared. Our life isn't working for us, and we have come for some help. And the help is here, but you have to be willing to take some directions other than your own thinking. That's the reason the sponsor. Attendance, regular attendance at your meetings, and especially any step meetings. You know, when I first came into Al-Anon, we did not have any step meetings. We had just discussion meetings, and that's where everybody got in and talked about the problem. Well, I'm here to tell you that you can talk about the problem all day long, but nothing changes till you get in the solution, and the solution is the 12 steps. That's where you begin to make the changes in your life. So, because I can go to a meeting on resentments, and before 2 or 3 minutes, I have one. Because when we start thinking about it, we can think about every resentment we've ever had. Now we're in a negative frame of mood, you know. So that's the reason, like I say, I love the step meetings. You're going to have to come with an open mind, you know, and it'll be easy to tell if you have an open mind. If you say, yes, but, what if, and I know, you do not have an open mind. And those were words that I had to remove from my vocabulary because I had a lot of yes, but, what if, and I know. Next thing you're going to have to do is learn to be honest with yourself. If you're never honest with anybody else, you must be honest with yourself. You have to have that rigorous self-honesty to be able to look at what you're doing and what you have done and how you're thinking and to be able to say, that's crazy. That doesn't work. Because how many times do we do the same thing over and over and over again with the idea that this time it's going to be different? And that's lying to yourself. Lying to yourself. And then you're going to have some willingness. You're going to have willingness to change. Willingness to do something different. And change, even good change, is scary. But what should scare you more is the thought that you're going to keep doing it the way you've been doing it forever and ever and ever. You know, when the fear of the known is greater than the fear of the unknown, you'll do something different. To know that it's never going to get any better until you do something different. So, that's my thing. Is there anything we can put under this to keep it from rocking? We've got quite a bit of rock going on off that front corner there, and that is really distracting. It's on the front corner. Yeah. It's much better. Thank you. Well, it was until you put all your weight on it.
Let me just stay right here all day.
That's good for you. Thank you. Here, I'll hold you. Thank you, Bonnie. How I got my sponsor is important, I think. I still have the same sponsor I started with. And as of January the 15th, I too will have 30 years. 30 years in Al-Anon. I can remember at my first meeting, there was a lady who got up and said she had 5 years, and my first thought was, stupid bitch. She's been in 5 years and she hadn't got it yet. My God, it's only 12 steps. Why could it? I use my sponsor. I talk to my sponsor on a regular basis because she's the one person who knows me better than anybody else. And she can catch me doing things when I'm just thinking about doing them. Because she can say sometimes, you got that look. You know, you got that look. Like I say, what I'm sharing today is not conference approved. You're going to hear me make mention of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because I worked the program through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the AA 12 and 12. These were, you know, when I came in 30 years ago, we didn't have all the literature we have today. I don't know if we need all the literature we have today, but we have it anyway. But what I'm saying is this was how I did it. And so this was how I did it, and this is how people I sponsor will do it, because that's the only thing I can share with you is my experience. I don't know how to do it otherwise than that. When I came into Al-Anon, I was a victim. I was blaming. I was a victim in life. Everything was not my fault. I had a lot of bad luck, and people were out to get me. And I want you to know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you either. I was arrogant, I was self-righteous, and I was dominating. I was all of those things that we talk about in the pamphlet, Understanding Ourselves. Understanding Ourselves, I was all those things. And the fear, like I say, the fear of the known became greater than the fear of the unknown, and so I was able to make a change. Now, the book says, here are the steps we took as a program of recovery. So the steps are the program of recovery. And if you're wondering if you're working the program, what step are you on right now? What step are you working right now? Because at all times, we need to be working on one of the steps. And I find that over the years, you keep going back through them again and again and again. And each time you go in, it's at a deeper level. And you see how much different it is today for you than it was in the beginning when you were working that step. It means so much more as the years go by. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, I'm big on words, you know. I love words, and I like to know the meaning of words, so I look things up in the dictionary all the time just to make sure. And understanding, you know, I'm going to talk about words today. Understanding leads to knowledge. Knowledge doesn't necessarily lead to wisdom. You see, I had knowledge. I was not stupid. I just acted that way. that was the thing that always confused me, because I always felt that all the solutions to life were within the pages of books. And if you read enough, if you're well read enough, if you study hard enough, then you ought to be able to figure the deal out, you know. And I had all this knowledge, but self-knowledge avails you nothing. All that self-knowledge avails you nothing, because you're fighting a disease. And you see, I thought I was fighting a person. I thought I was fighting alcohol. I didn't realize I was fighting a disease. And I had been fighting that disease all my life and had no clue. When you get here, you have your idea what you think an alcoholic is. Well, to me, an alcoholic was like my mother's father. An alcoholic was like my mother's family. My husband was not like those. So it was real easy to deny that he had that problem because he wasn't like them. And I didn't realize how them included me. My mother said to me one time, she says, why do you go to meetings with those kind of people? Because she looked down on alcoholics or anybody around them, and she had left and gotten away from her family years and years before. And I said, well, Mama, I guess I'm one of those kind of people. Because I always felt comfortable around the alcoholics. I always seemed drawn to them. But you know why? Because I love, my drug of choice is adrenaline. I love excitement. Doctor tells me too much is not a good thing. You know, too much of any positive becomes a negative. Do you ever know that? If you can do anything, you know, and my thing is, if it feels worth doing, do it till you die on the spot. And I love excitement, and when you're around an alcoholic, you never know what's happening, so therefore it's exciting, you know, in a way. And it's fun until it's in your home. Because I can remember when we were dating and he would be drunk or something, you know, this will pass. And when we get married, all this will change. And guess what? It did change. It got worse. It got worse. But, you know, at the time, that's what I'm thinking, you know. That's how it's going to be. All right, I'm powerless. What does powerless mean? Having no power over something. And what I found in one of the dictionaries was this definition. It says, unable to produce any kind of positive effect. And that was the truth. No matter what I tried when dealing with alcoholism, whatever I was doing, I could not produce a positive effect in what was happening. I couldn't get the end result, no matter what. And that was for him not to drink. For him not to drink. And I would go insane, literally, trying to get him not to drink. I could see what the disease was doing to him. I could not see what the disease was doing to me. I was powerless over that. I don't like the word powerless. I don't like it because it blew my whole theory of life as I knew it. You see, I was the kind of person, if I got one shred of success out of what I was trying to do, it works. Now, 99 didn't work, but the one did, so I'll go back to that one that did, thinking the whole deal was working, when in fact, it wasn't working, you know. And I considered myself a success on the ability to change or manipulate other people to do what I wanted them to do. And I learned manipulation very, very young in my life. I was a change of life baby. My daddy was 54 years old when I was born. My mother was 41. Neither one of them really wanted kids, I don't think, at that point. But I was a surprise. My mother had had to take treatments to get pregnant before with the other three. And so there's 16 years difference between me and my first sibling, 25 between me and the oldest. So I was an only child living in our home. And I learned to manipulate early because my daddy would do anything rather than hear me whine or complain. And so mama would tell me no, and I'd go into a screaming coma, and daddy would say, okay, okay, you can do it, you can do it. And I love my daddy. My daddy let me have my way, and I would have loved anybody who let me have my way. Okay, honesty. My reality was honesty. This doesn't mean it was necessarily the truth. You know, I would be honest in telling you what I thought things were happening and this is how it is, but it wasn't necessarily the truth of what was going on. There's a difference between honesty and truth, you know. That's just like there's a difference between fantasy and denial. That's just like the other day, I was reminded of this old story about there was a priest. It was a priest and a rabbi and an Al-Anon. And they all died and went to hell. And they're sitting there in hell discussing the situation. And so the priest looks over at the rabbi. He said, why are you in hell? He said, pork. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, when I was a kid, next door neighbors invited me over for supper one night. They had pork chops. I got the taste for pork. You know, we're not supposed to eat pork. It's unclean. That's why I'm here. Why are you here? And the priest said, well, it's sort of the same thing. It was the next door neighbor's daughter. I never could quite grasp that celibacy thing real well. And so they turned to the Al-Anon and they said, well, why are you here? She said, what do you mean? And they said, well, what did you do to get sent to hell? She said, it's not hot and I'm not here. It's like I told a dear friend the other day, we were doing what started out to be a really nice thing and turned into a nightmare, as things sometimes do. One of the gentlemen, in fact, it was real funny because he's from Toronto that I sponsor, and he's was down in Arkansas, and I was up here to be up here with y'all, and he'd come to my house, and for my birthday, he was painting my living room and kitchen and what have you. That's a really nice thing because that's a lot of work. But that's also a lot of chaos, confusion, and clutter. and I don't work real well in that kind of thing. I order really makes me more comfortable. And I told him, I said, and in Arkansas it was 117 degrees, and I said, it's hot, it's hell, and I'm here. I'm not. We got a charge out of that. But anyway, you have to have acceptance and surrender. You have to surrender to the fact that you can't change something, that you're powerless over something. And you know, the thing of it is, somehow I got the idea that all my ideas were good and that people should do what I said. People should mind me. You know, we always get along well if you mind me. But if you don't mind me, we're not going to do well here, you know. I had to, and another thing, I always thought that you had to agree with something or approve it in order to accept it. That's not true either. You don't have to like things to accept them. I don't like the fact there's a war going on all in lots of places in this world. But the fact is, it is. And you have to accept the reality that yes, that is. And people get killed in war. That is reality. That is reality. And we don't have to like it, but you must have to accept it. And I don't know where I got the idea that God had given me the ability to know what was best for everybody else to do. I don't know where that came from. You know, I seem to have it. But it was always amazing because people would come to me and ask me, what should we do? Even as a kid in school, other kids would come up, what do you think we ought to do? And I don't know why, because if you'd look at my life, why would anybody ask me what to do? If you're watching what I do, why would you ask me? And it's because I always had this air of superiority that went around saying, I'm smarter than everybody else. I know what to do. And you know why you had that? When you have an inferiority complex a mile wide, you act differently so that people can't hurt you. So that was the front that I would put up so that you couldn't get to me. And I was always terrified behind that something was going to happen that wasn't going to be well after what I told you to do. But it would always be because you didn't follow the directions properly. It was never my fault, you know. So over and over all my life, I tried to manage and control people. And did you know that control freaks, I'll get out here in a minute, are the most terrified people in the world? Because if you weren't terrified, you wouldn't find it necessary to have to get into that, you know, that little minutia control. You know, we do micromanagement, you know. We can say to somebody, you know, this is what you need to do, and now here's how you need to do it. Nee, 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 nee. Down to the very nth degree, you know, because we've got to micromanage that to make sure that it goes the way we want it to go. And control is often disguised in logic. I would say I'm a very logical person. Think things through. I'm a big thinker. And my sponsor always says, when I tell her I've been thinking, she goes, oh God, not again. Because my thinking is sort of skewed sometimes, you know. More often than not, come to think about it, you know. And logic is the ability to reason clearly. And that is without preconceived ideas and agendas and all like that. And I just considered myself a logical person, and I set about trying to get everything to go the way I wanted it to go. I had all these logical reasons why you should agree and co-sign whatever idea I came up with. And my husband said he used to hate to have a discussion with me about something because he said he knew he was never going to win. Because no matter what he said, I would have another comeback to it to explain to him why what he said wasn't applying here, it wasn't correct, or you just don't understand, you know. That was the way I would go about him. Now, my way is always the correct way. It's my way, what else? Well, you know, even years later, you know, I have learned in the program that acceptance and surrender are some of the hardest things to learn. Some of the hardest, and I'll miss it. Now, my husband is big in the yard work. He loves his yard. He's out there all the time. And I decided, well, I could have a yard work project as well. Now, I'm not a big outdoors person. You're not going to find, I do not do rustic. Rustic is even a motel with a black and white TV. I don't do rustic, you know. But I decided I wanted this magnificent flower bed in front of my home. And so I got out there and I designed my flower bed. And I said, well, it's not too bad. We'll make it, you know, like about maybe, you know, 50 foot long and about 15 foot deep. That ought to do it. That'll do it, all right. And then I went to the quarry and I got all these rocks. And they all had to be the same size because I'm going to make a border for this flower bed. And it's a free-form border that I have designed. I have this little template. And so I take my template with me to the quarry, and I'm laying out the rocks one at a time around my template. And the guy at the quarry says, I've never seen it done that way. Well, these rocks are, they're New Mexico river-washed rocks, and they're very expensive, and I didn't want one too many or one too few. You got to have just the right number. So the way to do that is you lay them out exactly the way they're going to be when you get them there. Took a whole day. Got my rocks, took them home, laid them out, and I planted a bunch of elephant ears next to the brick of our home, and I planted the hostas I was going to do across the front in this scalloped area, and I had a solid, a variegated, looked very, very wonderful to me. And between those was this big expanse, you know, because we got this wide deal. I had 17 flats of impatience. Now, flats are lots of impatience, you know. Now, impatience was a good flower for me. Sort of explains. And they were all different colors, so it's going to be this, you know, wonderful thing. And after days of little holes and poking, we got all of the flowers in, and I stood back and I said, now it's time to fertilize. Well, now at home we have a product called Miracle-Gro. I guess y'all have it up here too. But at home there's a commercial, and this guy's standing there, and he says, I grew a 50-pound tomato with my Miracle-Gro. And I said, yes, that's what I need, Miracle-Gro. And the instructions said once a month to put a solution of Miracle-Gro on your plants. Well, if once a month is good, I'm thinking, once a week is better, isn't it? Never too much of a good thing. And pretty soon I have got a yard that when people drive by, they stop. They've never seen 4 foot tall impatiens. I have elephant ears that go to the roof, you know. I mean, it's amazing, you know. And I was standing there waiting to do my Miracle-Gro endorsements, you know. I know they're going to come and ask me to do the TV thing because it's so nice out there. Well, the only problem was one night I came home and there was a hole in the middle of my impatiens. Now, impatiens are very tender little plants and they break easily. And here it was that there was a big hole that just smashed flat and broken off even with the ground in my impatiens. Oh, I mean, it's almost coronary time because you see, perfection is ruined. Because even if I plant more impatiens, they're not going to be the same height as the other impatiens. You know, it's just screwed up. Now I'm mad and I want to know what happened here. Now, I don't know what that's going to change. But you see, we are gatherers of information that we can't do jack with once we got. And finally, my husband said, I think I found the problem. And I said, what? He said, look out there. There is this cat that is lurking in my little jungle of impatience so he can eat the birds at my bird feeder, and he's breaking down my impatience. I hate cats. I've hated cats my whole life. When I was a little kid, my sister had a Siamese cat, jumped on me. I had to have 16 stitches. I don't like cats. I don't trust cats. Don't want to be around cats. And now I've got a cat. It's a feral cat out there in the flower bed. Got to get rid of the cat. So now here, if you ever need a solution for anything, go to your Al-Anon meeting early. And while sitting there before the meeting, ask somebody, how do you get rid of a cat? For as many people there, you will have a solution. And the first one said, you know, if you mothballs, they hate mothballs, put mothballs out there in your flower bed. Well, I went and got me several boxes of mothballs. You could smell my house from three blocks away. Didn't bother my cat. Another one said hot pepper because she said the cracked cayenne pepper because they walk on it and they lick their paws. They won't like that. I must have a Mexican cat. Didn't bother my cat. And there was all these other methods I'm trying. And as they do that, of course, the season's going on. And so then I decided toward the end of the season, somebody suggested, you know, a gun. And I thought, that's good. So I had a pellet gun, a rifle. And so I pumped it up to about 3, and I walked out the door. And I'd look for the cat, and the cat would look for me. You know, we got to be real adversaries. And I would see the cat over there, and I'd aim, and I'd shoot the cat in the butt, and he'd go, meow. And the next day, he'd be back again. So I would pump it up some more, a little stronger, this go around, and I would shoot him, and he'd go, meow. And then he would be back again. And so finally, I pumped it up to 10, as hard as I could pump that gun. And so I shot him. I missed. I knocked a hole in the next door neighbor's house. The end of the season, the next year, I plant more impatience and I water my impatience, and here comes the cat again. You know, we're each doing the same thing, expecting something different. I can see him doing it. I'm not seeing me do it. My sponsor's laughing hysterically. She thinks it's the funniest thing in the world. Well, I went through several more things that didn't work, and then finally, I decided, you know, I have a gun. I'm just going to shoot him. I'm going to kill the cat, and then I will be done with the cat. Done with the cat. And I have a friend who raises golden retrievers, and they're show dogs. And he told me, he said, you know, I live out in the country, and this little stray dog came up. And he said, I thought he lived at the house down the road, and I called him. They said, no, it wasn't theirs. Just go ahead and kill it. And he said, so I shot it. He said, but the tragedy was I didn't kill him on the first go-round. And he said, I'll never forget that scream if I live to be 1,000. Well, thanks for sharing, Skip. Now I have to think about, what if I don't kill the cat on the first shot? You know, what if I don't kill him? You know, I mean, you get hit with a .38, it's going to do some damage on you. But nonetheless, what if I don't kill him on the first shot? Okay, I better not try that. And it's like, well, what do you do? What do you do? And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden it's like, don't you see what you're trying to do here? No, what am I trying to do? You're trying to change the nature of a cat. A cat is a predator. Cats go out and kill birds and things to eat and what have you. This is a feral cat. He's killing for his food. You're not going to change, and you've provided a perfect habitat for the birds and the squirrel to stalk him amongst the big, tall plants. So it's your fault he's eating your birds and squirrels because you provided the jungle for him to hide in. And now you're expecting him not to do what is his nature to do. Oh, God. So now my sponsor has this thing about you accept it to the point that you would not change it if you could. Now, that's a big order. What an order. I can't go through with that. Anyway, so you act as if until it becomes. So I go outside and I go, welcome to my yard, FC. That's the cat's name, you know. I said, do whatever you want to do. It's your yard. You can be the yard cat. And I come back in the house. My husband's looking at me like I've lost my mind. He said, I would never believe I'd seen that. And I said, well, don't believe it either. I said, I'm acting as if until it becomes. I'm going to act as if it's okay for the cat to be there. And so the next morning I get up, I'm doing my reading and my meditation, and I happen to look out my front window. And one of my happy squirrels is chewing a limb off of my bonsai tree. Well, you know, a bonsai tree don't have very many limbs, start with, you know. And here's this squirrel just gnawing the limb off my tree, and I went tearing out my front door. Where the hell is my cat? Eat this squirrel! I don't see my cat anywhere. And I noticed this guy driving by is looking real strange, and I'm thinking, what is the matter with you? And I happen to look down, I'm out in my front yard in my underwear. To say I'm obsessed with my yard, you know. Zip back in the house. I'm thinking, my Lord, have mercy. And you know, the funny thing about it is I never saw FC again. And that just tells me, though, my sponsor says once you accept it, the problem goes away. And literally, FC went away. And for many years, you know, I would look for FC, you know, but I quit planting impatience too, you know. But nonetheless, I didn't see FC. And then one day I was up in Seashell, BC, there at a conference. And as I went into this little motel there right on the ocean, there's this giant calico cat, which was what FC was. And I said, well, I'll be damned. FC, you went to BC. I can't believe this. And this summer, I have seen offspring of FC. I've seen another calico cat in the neighborhood. Not in my yard, but nonetheless, I've seen it. You know, when you're a manager controller, sometimes you disguise it by being a fixer, or we're going to help you. Just need some help. We help people who have never asked for help and then wonder why they're not appreciative. Did you ever think about that? You know, normal. What is normal? You know, people say, you know, well, it's normal. I'm going, normal is a setting on a washing machine. Other than that, I don't know normal, you know, because normal means well-adjusted to the outside, you know, well-adjusted, something that's usual. That doesn't describe anything in my life, because my life has always been bizarre. We use rationalization and justification a lot. This is where you give explanations and excuses instead of accepting responsibility for behavior. That's all that amounts to. I had a friend in AA many years ago, and she said, rationalization and justification are just like masturbation. You're just screwing yourself. I find that's pretty much true. Did you know as long as you're blaming other people, there's no hope for you? As long as it's their fault, there's no hope for you because you're powerless over them. But if what you're doing contributes to your misery, you can stop that. And there is the hope. It's not in the other people. And my life was unmanageable because I had lost control of my emotions and my actions. And if you don't control your emotions, they will control you. Make no mistake of that. Fear and anger controlled my life when I got here. I was terrified of stuff, but I wouldn't look at it as fear because the anger would come, and anger made you feel powerful. So I didn't even know I was afraid, but I knew I was mad about everything. Everything made me mad. Everything made me mad. It was the only emotion I had left. I had to accept that alcoholism is a disease. I didn't know it was a disease. I had seen it in my mother's family. I had seen it in my own home. I didn't know it was a disease. I had come in the program. Y'all told me it was a disease. I couldn't see it as a disease. I'd say, I know they're not lying to me, but I don't see it. I just don't see it. And then one day God let me see it. I was sitting in my office having a crisis of some major. I never had a minor crisis in my life. Crisis can't be minor. The word crisis means big, for God's sake. And I don't know how to handle an incident. Blow it into a crisis. I can deal with crisis. You know. Anyway, I was sitting there, and my sponsor was at work. I couldn't get a hold of her, and there was this other girl in the group that I listened to a lot. And so I called her, and she was at home. And she said, why don't you take off on your break or whatever and drive over to the house and we'll talk about it. I said, okay. So I went over to her house and I drove up, and when I got to the front door and opened the door, her husband was laying in the floor at the threshold. She said, just step over, Bobby, and come on. Well, Bobby didn't look very good. Bobby didn't smell very good. Bobby had been drinking till he would pass out, coming to and drinking till he would pass out for several days. And he had relieved himself in every way possible on himself for several days. And we got to her kitchen and she said, well, what's the problem? I don't know. I mean, I've just seen something that how could you invite somebody to your home when there's that situation at the front? And she said, well, honey, Bobby's sick. She said, could you imagine anybody in their right mind wanting to live like that? No. She says, he's sick. She says, he's been there for several days. And she says, I can't do anything about it, but my life goes on. And maybe I can help you, but I can't help Bobby. I came to believe it was a disease. Who would want to live like that? Who would have a choice over something to live like that? You see, the disease had removed the choice from Bobby. And she had accepted that she couldn't fix that. And so she was living her life to the best of her ability. That spoke volumes to me. You see, the thing in the program, we can talk to one another all day long, but it's when you're living it and you see people living it that it makes a difference, you know. In AA, they tell them they have three choices. They either do abstinence, insanity, or death. In Al-Anon, we also have three choices. Acceptance, insanity, or death. Because if you do not accept it's a disease, it will drive you crazy. And it will kill you one way or another. Sometimes it kills your spirit before your body ever goes. That's sad. You know, that's sad. There's common tools of the manager and controller of the world. And those common tools are questions. Who, what, when, where, how, and why? Beware of the adverbs. These are things that we ask trying to figure it out. Well, even if you know why, what difference does it make? Does it change anything? And why did I always want to know? Why did you do that? Why did you not do that? Because if I can get inside your head and figure you out, I can head you off at the pass. I can outthink you. I can maneuver you. I can manipulate you if I can figure out how you think. And it doesn't work. It does not work. Step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. A higher power. What was my higher power? I was my higher power. There was no higher power than me. Now, I wasn't always like that. But from the age of 12, I was. You see, my daddy, I worshiped my daddy. We had all the fun in the world together. And my daddy would take me with him fishing and hunting because he retired and he raised bird dogs. And we trained them and we'd go hunting and we'd go fishing. And I just loved being with my daddy. My mother was a workaholic. My mother felt like if you weren't working and producing something, you had no value whatsoever. So she would stay at home. And when I'd go to my mother about something, she'd say, shut up, leave me alone. Can't you see I'm busy? My daddy always had time for me. I made the mistake of thinking Daddy loved me and Mama didn't. Mama loved me, but not in the way that my daddy showed it. My daddy was an affectionate person. And so I didn't know that. Well, on November the 30th of 1954, when I was 12 years old, I watched my daddy die of a heart attack. And my world ended. And I knew that we went to church every time the doors opened and that kind of thing. And I knew it was all a lie. Because if God loved me, he wouldn't have taken my daddy and left me with the witch. It was just real simple. And so I turned my back on any kind of spiritual guidance from that point forward. It's like, did I quit going to church? No, you had to go to church. But you just don't buy the deal. You know, you just sit there, you go through the motions, you say what they expect you to say. You know, you learn to do those kind of things. But do you believe it on the inside for you? No, I did not. I did not believe that God loved me. I did not believe that God cared for me. I did not believe that God would be there walking with me through my life. I had no idea that was happening. And you know, that's the neat thing about God. Whether you know it or not, it doesn't change the fact that He is. And He does. But anything that happened to me that was good, I thought was good luck or something that I had done. Anything that was bad was your fault or God was trying to get me. That was my attitude when I came. And so I told my sponsor, I said, I don't believe in God. She said, you don't have to. Just believe in a power greater than you. And I said, well, what do you... She said, well, is what you're doing working? No. Well, then... Take some direction outside of yourself. So my sponsor became my higher power for a while. And then my group, more, you know, two heads are better than one. That was my higher power. And it's just like the step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I came and I came and I came and one day I came too. And then I could believe. It was a process for me. It was not an event of one day. You know, you hear it over and over in the meetings used to, let go and let God, let go and let God. You know, we don't say that so much in our meetings anymore. I don't know why, but you just don't hear it a lot. And it's let go and let God, let go and let God. And so what happened, I was driving down the road, and my car had been giving me lots of problems. And I had taken it in, and the guy had told me, he says, your carburetor is full of trash. It needs to be cleaned out. And he said, what happens is that you're driving along and my car would just turn itself off and I was powerless because I had power steering, power brakes, all like that. Now you got to just, it's like herding a logging wagon over to the side and trying to get it stopped. And he said, you need to get your carburetor rebuilt. And I said, I don't have any money to get my carburetor rebuilt. You see, my husband had gotten sober and he got fired. And he was out of work for over 6 months. And so I was the only support of the family, and it was doing well to be able to afford my lunches and things. And it was like, I just can't afford it. And so the guy said, well, here, he says, what happens is, he says, trash is getting in those jets on that carburetor. And if you take your breather off and you pour a little gas in the top and start your car, it's going to backfire. Maybe that'll knock that trash loose enough to where it'll get you along. And it would. It would do that. And if you don't mind smelling like a gas pump all day long. And but you do what you have to do. And I do that about every day or two. And then it got to where I was having to do it every day. And then I got to where I was having to do it more than once a day because it was getting worse and worse. And I just couldn't handle it. I just couldn't handle it. It was getting on my last nerve. I don't know about y'all, but after a while, you just get worn down. You just can't stand it anymore. And so on this one particular day going home from work, I went by to see the nemesis on my way home, my mother. I never went to my mother's that I didn't leave there hurt and mad. Because if you hurt me, it made me mad. Remember, any feeling I have is anger. And my mother would say very cruel and mean things to me, and she was just being mother. And I would take those things to heart. Because, you see, I kept going to my mother wanting her to approve of me. I wanted to hear my mother just say one time, I love you. You know, that wasn't going to happen. Because no matter what I did, it was never enough. I never could do it to right. I never could do it enough to suit my mother. And so I left there that day, and I got a few blocks away, and my car stopped again. And I was just worn completely out. And all of a sudden, in my head, I heard, let go and let God. Let go and let God. And I'm going, this is a car. Yeah, you know, isn't it funny how we have these conversations in our head that's just, you know, a whole committee going off at once, you know. And so I got out, and I had just a little bit of gas left in that, and I said, okay, God, if there be a God for me. Now, I believe there was God for other people because they were good people. They were nice. They hadn't done the things I had done. I wasn't worthy of God loving me. And I was afraid that if I asked God to do something, and he refused, it was all over. So if you never ask, you don't have to be worrying about it. But I was worn out. And so that day I said, God, if there be a God, this is Mary Pearl Thompson. I live at 409 Healy Street in North Little Rock, Arkansas. You see, I didn't want God mixing me up with anybody else. And I'm serious, you know. And I said, all I want to do is just get home. I'm just tired. I'm worn out. I want to get home. And I started my car, and it backfired, and then it quit. And then I tried to start it. It was just jerking and whatever. And I said, God, it won't get there like that. It won't get there. And I tried again, and it was still missing. I said, God, can't you just straighten this thing out and get me home? That's all I'm asking. It's not a big deal. I just want to get home. And just like that, the engine straightened out, and I drove home. And when I pulled in my driveway, I did something I had never done before in my life. I got out of the car. I knelt down by the side of my car in my grass, and I thanked a power greater than me for getting me home. And that began the journey. That began the journey. Because you can't do much without a higher power. You just can't do it, you know. This first step is I can't. And the second step is God can. And you see, God could do something I couldn't do. I couldn't make that car do. And you know, immediately I went in the house, and within an hour's time, I got a telephone call from a girlfriend I'd gone to school with, whose daddy was a top mechanic at a dealership there, and he had retired. And I hadn't heard from her in years. And she said, how are things going? Well, you know how we are. Well, God, let me tell you about my car. My car is just falling apart, you know. And so she said, well, why don't you call my daddy? I bet he'd fix it. I said, I don't have any money to get it fixed. And she said, well, my daddy's retired. I bet he'd fix it and let you pay it off as you could. I said, you think? And she said, well, why don't you call him and see? And so I called her daddy. He was over there in about 30 minutes with a wrecker, picked up my car, took it, fixed it, gave me another car to use until it was ready. You see, all of a sudden now, that God that I had called for help, things are beginning to happen now in my life. And these may seem like little things, but they were major miracles. And I couldn't wait to call my sponsor and say, guess what God did for me? And she says, oh, I'm so glad. I was so tired of praying for you all the time. Because, see, I'd call her and I'd say, well, you pray to your God because, see, I don't have one. And so she'd say, I'll pray for you. You know, and so I leaned on her faith till I could have some, you know. And so anyway, then I began to realize that there's no such thing as good luck. It's called God luck, you know. And God began to do little things for me. And it was those little everyday miracles, those little things, you know. And I had a girl one time says, God never does anything for me. I said, oh, really? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, anytime you see something good happening in your life, you take a marble and put it in a little glass vase on your windowsill. And I said, we'll call that your miracle jar. And every time something good happens, you put that little marble in there. And I said, and then the morning when the sun comes through that window, you can see all that miracle, that rainbow will happen in your room because the rainbow is a big miracle. And she said, okay. And, you know, I've had thousands of marbles on my windowsill in big jars and stuff and then transfer them over into urns and things because there's miracles happening every day in your life, whether you're aware of it or not. And it took me a while to realize that that power that I came to believe in that day going down the highway, going home, I began to see where that same power had been working in my life all my life. I just never gave him credit. I just never gave him credit for what he was doing. I took credit or thought it was just good luck, you know, those kind of things. Because, you know, I found that seeing is believing. Faith is believing without having to see. But I had to see to believe to begin with. You know, it's like taking baby steps. Before you can take big giant steps, you got to learn how to walk, you know. And I knew my sponsor believed, and so therefore she would believe, you know. So I met the God of my understanding on the England Highway going home that day. Later on, my sponsor said to me, she says, you going to the convention? And I said, what's that? She says, well, they have the old granddad. It's the biggest AA convention, the oldest west of the Mississippi down in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And I said, well, you know, we can't afford to go to any convention. JD's not got a job. And I went and she said, it was a yes or no question. Isn't it funny how we get a yes or no question and we go into this dissertation, you know, and I just wait till they get through, and I'll go, it was a yes or no question. I just love it when I can pass those things on, she did to me. You know, that's how you get revenge, you know. Anyway, she said, well, have you prayed about it? No. Because, you see, it wasn't my custom to pray about every little thing. You pray about main, bigger things. But she said, well, why don't you ask God if it's His will that you go to the convention? What a concept. So I go home and I said to my husband, I said, J.D., I said, my sponsor says we ought to go to that convention. And he says, well, you know, my sponsor says the same thing. And he said, but how are we going to fight? I said, I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work. And he said, oh. And I said, well, my sponsor suggested we pray about it. You want to pray together about it? Do we have to pray out loud? And I said, no, I don't guess so. I usually do, but that's okay. And so that night before we went to bed, we knelt together by the side of the bed, first time ever. We held hands, and I said, God, if we're supposed to go to the convention, please show us a way. Please help. That's it. No big deal. Not a big prayer. I got up the next day and went to work. Now, I found out in prayer, my sponsor said, if there's something you're supposed to do, you do that, and what you can't do, God will do for you. So what can I do? I can call and make a hotel reservation. We had a company, Watts Line, wouldn't cost me anything. So I got on the phone, I called down to Hot Springs, made a reservation. 30 minutes later, J.D. called. He'd gotten a job. He'd gotten a job. We had knelt together, and he got a job. How amazing was that? And so then I began to figure, let's see, now how much is it going to cost? There's registration, there's the hotel room, there's the gas down to Hot Springs and back, there's the meals and stuff. And I began to figure up what we'd have to have, bare minimum, if we ate cheese and crackers for every meal. You know, it wouldn't be optimum, but I mean, it would be survivable, but you'd get to go to the convention. And so we're saving. Now, my sponsor told me it wasn't right for me to take the money that I needed to pay bills to go to the convention because that was taking away from the people that I owed the bills. So this had to be above and beyond. Well, now J.D.'s working, but he'd been off over 6 months, so we were behind. So this was very tricky, how to save a few dollars. And J.D. said to me one night, he says, I don't have anything to wear to a convention. You see, we didn't know. We had never been. And God forbid you should ask somebody something, because then they'll know you don't know. You know. And so always a convention, you think in terms of suit and nice clothes and what have you. And so I said, I don't know how in the world we're going to afford you a new suit, because these were the days of polyester back in the 70s. And J.D. was a smoker. And when he drank, so his clothes looked like colanders, you know, where he'd drop his ashes and they'd melt all these little holes all over him. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, the colander man. No, we couldn't have that. And so it was real funny because I got a thing in the mail from a mail order place in Chicago that had a closeout on suits. Said it was two pairs of pants, a reversible vest, and a jacket for $49.95. And that was nothing back then. And I thought, can't be much. My sponsor said, well, you'll never know if you don't try, do you? And so I said, we've prayed, okay. So we sent off to get the deal. And the week of the convention, the suit came in, and I had already checked all of our finances, and we were $35 short at a bare minimum. And I thought, well, we've tried. We tried, but we're $35 short, and so I can go to work tomorrow, and I can call and cancel, and it won't cost us anything. And so J.D.'s trying on that suit that night, and when he puts on that second pair of pants, and it was a gorgeous suit. That was amazing to me. He said, wait a minute. He says, is there an inspection tag or something here in the pocket? And he pulls out a 20, a 10, and a 5. And I said, I'd never have thought to tell God to put it there. We We sat there and we held each other and we cried. And we thanked God for making it possible for us to go to the convention. And when we got there, somebody invited us out for every meal. So we didn't have to eat cheese and crackers in the room, you know. Because the people of Alcoholics Anonymous knew we were struggling and we were trying and we were newcomers. And they were out. And they're the most loving group of people, alcoholics and Al-Anons, that there are. And so it was time for the banquet was going to be on Saturday night. And so we had our cheese and crackers. And the thing about it was they had so many people, 1,800 people back in those days was major convention. And they had it on closed circuit TV in your room because we couldn't get a ticket to go. And so we were sitting there feeling sorry for ourselves. We're going to watch it in your room. Now, the fact that we've had all these meals and all this stuff, we're going to feel sorry for ourselves. You know, gratitude doesn't last long with newcomers. And there was a knock at the door and went over to the door and there's nobody there. And as I start back across the room, J.D. says, "What's that in the floor?" And there was an envelope in the floor. And in the envelope were two banquet tickets. And so we went down and we were seated at the table with all the speakers. And it just so happened that night that there was a man there who was a speaker from Texas. His name was Jim W. And Jim was one of the funniest people in the whole world. And he had a way about him. And the program came alive listening to Jim that night. It was just what we needed, you know. It was just what we needed. And God provided all of that. And we never knew who did that, you know. We never knew. And it wasn't important. What's been important is we've been able to do things like that, to return those things. See, pass it on to other people. Pass it on, those kind of things. When I focus on the problems, nothing changes. When I start focusing on doing what I need to do and focus on making a change, I get change. Things change. You know, whatever you look for. This step says, restore you to sanity. Well, is that insulting or what? Does that sort of intimate that you may be a little off-center? You know, I didn't dream that I was insane. But when I look back at it, my God, you know, I mean, at the time I'm going, but don't you see, I'm the one that held the family together. I'm the one that kept the job. I'm the one that kept the bills going. I'm also the one that kept making the bills. You know, see, I didn't notice that for a long time because J.D. would go out and spend money we didn't have. Well, if he can, so can I. Is that nuts or what? You know, well, he quit drinking, so the money for the alcohol and the jails and the fines and all like that went away. But you see, when he'd do that, I'd go to the mall to make myself feel better. And it took me 10 years to cover what I had done at the mall while he was drinking. He drank 7 years after we were married, and during that 7 years, I amounted to do enough debt to last us 17. Isn't that interesting? You know.